Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So Republicans have control of the White House and Congress, and they dominate in state and local governments. So how are the Democrats feeling about all this? Hopeful? Fired up? Despondent? Well, according to my next guest, political scientist Rui Teixeira, if they aren't optimistic about the future, they should be. He's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and Center for American Progress, and he's certain that the left's future is promising. In his new book, The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think, he writes, it is not the case that the left is at the mercy of the right. The form of the left is changing, but its numbers are strong and growing. It remains a vital force, the vital force for reforming capitalism. So we'll get his take on the Republican House Caucus Obamacare replacement bill unveiled last night, and much more from his book as Rui Teixeira joins me now to unpack this positivity. Welcome back to WNYC, Rui.
Delighted to be here.
So the premise of the book is that the left will dominate the 21st century, and there's little the right can do about it. It's a little hard to see that right now, considering the presidency, Congress, and all these state houses.
Yeah, no, I grant you it seems a bit counterintuitive, but this book is designed to help people on the left take the long view and not necessarily get caught up in what's happening in the short term and the pessimistic conclusions they might draw from that. What I try to emphasize in the book, among other things, is if you look back on the last 50 to 100 years, I mean, the progress the left has made has been absolutely extraordinary. And that even includes, you know, since the late 1970s, when we've had an era of relatively rising inequality, the left has still achieved some fantastic things in terms of the environment, in terms of social equality and tolerance. And of course, during the Obama administration, we saw significant forward progress as well, and things like the Affordable Care Act and so on. So, I mean, we're having a populist moment in Western capitalism, and the United States is not immune to that. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that pretty much everything the left has accomplished is going to be very difficult to roll back. I mean, Trump is not going to be able to abolish the Environmental Protection Agency. Back when George W. Bush was around, he tried to push back against a single regulation that Clinton had put in about levels of arsenic in drinking water. And the blowback was so fantastic that they had to drop it immediately. A lot of what Trump is talking about is just talk. And I think that even extends to the issue of the Affordable Care Act, where obviously they're trying to, as they say, repeal and replace it. But, you know, the first attempts along these lines have already crashed and burned. They've got a new plan now. It's already getting a lot of incoming from the right in terms of the Libertarian Caucus. There's a bunch of Republican senators who are very upset about the Medicaid expansion being taken away in 2020. There are just so many moving parts here that it's going to be very difficult for them to actually get a plan through that does what they say it's going to do. And in fact, this is generally tends to be the history of social programs in the United States, is they come in, they're attacked, there's attempts at rollback, but in the long run, what really happens is the programs get built on and improved, because once you give people benefits, it's very hard to take them away. And this is one reason why the right gets so hysterical about social programs that get implemented by Democrats. They actually are somewhat aware of this pattern, that once things like the Affordable Care Act are put in place, they're extremely difficult to get rid of. And over time, people really like them. They like the benefits. They support them. They don't want them taken away. And that's really what the left stands for, among other things, is trying to put things in place that help people, that provide put the government on the side of ordinary people and make their lives better and give them more opportunity. And I think those values and priorities are, in fact, what will carry the day over the medium to long run. Now, Trump will obviously do some damage in the meantime, though let's keep in mind a lot of the stuff he's trying to do is actually stuff any Republican president would have tried to do. But I think the pushback, as we're already seeing, is enormous, and I don't think they'll make nearly the progress a lot of people on the left fear.
And listeners, if you're on the left and you're optimistic and you want to talk to Rui Teixeira, author of The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think, or if you want to tell him that he's got his head in the sand and his pie in the sky, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-WNYC. 800-259-9692. Let me follow up on a few things that you just said. One, with respect to Obamacare in particular, do you think that Obamacare established certain norms for covering people that the Republicans won't be able to banish? It does seem like almost everything is on the table, even when they talk about no denials for pre-existing conditions, which supposedly everybody wants. Well, Trump changed it in a speech last night to people with people with pre-existing conditions will have access to care. And some Republicans want that to mean a high risk pool where people would still have to pay a lot more money for insurance if they have pre-existing conditions or any of the other things. What do you think the rock solid norms are that got established by Obamacare that are going to be politically bulletproof?
Well, I think the rock solid norms are basically that the government has a significant and central role to play in making sure everyone has coverage, that you shouldn't be denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions. And basically, those are the fundamental principles of a national health care system. I mean, the very idea of a national health care system, I think, has become a bedrock value. And I think that's one reason the Republicans are having such trouble coming up with something to agree on, because the fact of the matter is a system has been put into place that actually provides something along those lines. It is imperfect. It doesn't function with 100% efficiency, but it does function pretty well and has made enormous progress in terms of giving people health insurance and, for example, allowing people of pre-existing conditions to get health care. I think those things are very, very hard to take away. So they may talk about and debate about how they're going to take away these things or try to take away these things, but the pushback even within their own caucus is enormous. And we haven't, I mean, this new plan, for example, hasn't even been scored by CBO in terms of how much it costs and how many people it'll throw off the health insurance. So we're already seeing blowback on this plan before those important kind of items of information come in and people react to them. So I really do think that Obamacare has changed the terrain on which we discuss the issue of health care in the United States and changed it fundamentally and radically. And that's a terrain the Republicans now have to play on. And I think that's one reason why they're having such difficulty figuring out what the hell to do.
It sounds like you're basing your optimism for the left on its role in reforming capitalism, per se. I think with Trump, we see two different strands, at least. One is this kind of identity nationalism, that has the nativism and the xenophobia and things like that, this cultural nationalism. They also talk about economic nationalism. And in some respects, Steve Bannon at least presents himself as a big government nationalist. They don't want changes to Medicare or Social Security. They want a big infrastructure program. In other ways, I'm not so sure. But can the left score victories through the Trump administration that are particular to this nationalist frame of theirs?
Well, I'm not sure how many victories the left will actually have in the short term within a Trump administration. But I do think that you're hitting on something there that's very important, which is that it's a bug, not a feature of the current Republican coalition, that it has this vast swath of popular support and very significant political actors within the elites who have basically rejected the standard austerity, quasi-libertarian economics that had dominated the Republican Party for 20 years. I mean, this is not a type of political economics that is sympathetic to the idea or intrinsically in tune with the idea that, as Paul Ryan would prefer, the government spend as little as possible, tax as little as possible, and basically we should privatize any social program we can get our hands on. That's not a popular trope with the kind of people who put Donald Trump into office. With a lot of the people around him, it's not a popular way of looking at things either. And so this populist impulse that's been captured within the Republican Party and that allowed Trump through a series of adept moves, capitalizing on sentiments in a certain area of the country to become president, this is actually potentially blowing apart the economic, I think it's already blowing apart the economic consensus within the Republican Party on that type of ultra-free market economics. And I think that's ultimately good for the left. The more people are willing to debate about what the government should do and how much money it should spend and what way it should spend it and whose side it should be on, that's a much better debate for Democrats than the debate about should government do anything at all and isn't, you know, what government does fundamentally worthless and counterproductive. We now are in a different, I think, terrain where the debate in the medium to long term will favor the Democrats, because I think what people want the government to do, what they, the people especially who put Donald Trump into office, wants the government to do is solve their problems, make their lives better. My guess is that Trump will not succeed in that regard, but in so doing, he opens up a debate that's very good for Democrats and very good for the left. The government should, in fact, help people have better lives. It should, in fact, do things that help solve their problems. It shouldn't just try to get rid of government, you know, as fast and as far as possible. So I think that that populist impulse that has now been channeled within the Republican Party creates an extremely unstable ideological and political coalition for them.
Stephanie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Rui Teixeira. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess on the topic of channeling, and given that it's just the day before the Day of the Woman, one thing that occurred to me that I think could be reason for optimism is over the past several years, you know, you see a lot of articles come up about women who are very well educated, had fairly high powered jobs, and then took a step back to take care of children and this kind of thing. I'm one of them, and I know many, many of them. And it just occurred to me all of a sudden that I know they're not all liberal, but you've got this huge group of people out there who I think are very well educated, extremely capable, and totally underutilized. And I think a number of them have just been handed a huge project that they can get to work on and use all their firepower. So I think that's a reason
for optimism for progressivism going forward. Stephanie, thank you very much. Rui, what did you say to Stephanie, and how shocked were you by the results of the election with respect to 53% of white women, even after the Access Hollywood tape and everything else, voting for Trump, even 45% of college-educated white women?
Yeah, well, I think what Stephanie's getting at is that there's an enormous amount of potential energy out there among, you know, particular groups that feel targeted by the Trump administration, and that can be unleashed. And in fact, I think to some extent already is being unleashed. Now, that doesn't mean that all women are going to be activated in the way she suggests, but I think a lot of the women who voted for Clinton or thought about voting for Clinton are going to be getting out there and doing things to try to stop what they perceive to be attacks upon them. I don't think we should ever think just because, you know, X number of women voted for Donald Trump that therefore they endorsed his views on things. In fact, they were voting for him not because of those views and his actions, but in spite of them. And that was particularly true for a lot of non-college women who voted for him. Their basic view was, yeah, he says these things and that's bad, but, you know, the system needs to be shaken up. And in fact, he's the guy to do it, so I'm willing to overlook these things. And I think that was true for a lot of college-educated white women as well. They didn't vote for him because they liked what he said. They voted for him in spite of it. So he's already, in a sense, got a, you know, black mark against him in the minds of a lot of these voters before he even comes into office, because he's sort of, in a sense, living on borrowed time. And I think part of what's happening now is why his approval ratings are so terrible. Don't forget, this was a guy who had a 60% unfavorable rating when he got, you know, into office, you know, he got elected. So I think no one's forgotten about the things that he did and said. And as time goes on and sort of the outrages accumulate, and he doesn't actually seem to improve people's lives very much or make the country a much better place, I think those things will hurt him. We have to remember that, you know, a lot of the way people vote in this country is determined by their party identification. And there's an awful lot of Republican-leaning women who voted for Trump simply because he wasn't Hillary Clinton and because they were willing to overlook some of the things he said. But that doesn't mean they've forgotten about them.
We'll continue in a minute with Rui Teixeira, author of The Optimistic Leftist, and more of your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with political scientist Rui Teixeira, author of The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. And Alan in Long Beach, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an optimistic progressive as well. However, with the reality of gerrymandering and the reality of the Electoral College, what would the strategy best be to use all this energy that the left has now, rather than getting angry and throwing things at the TV? What do you do? I mean, waiting around for demography to do its thing, I don't think is a strategy. So I'd like to hear the thoughts.
Rui, go ahead.
Sure. Well, the passage of time will, in fact, mitigate some of these structural problems. But I think you're perfectly right. That isn't a strategy. That's a interesting fact that we should think about and keep track of. And I think people are who do, big data type analyses for the left. But I think the solution, to the extent there is one, there's no automatic, solution to this, no magic bullet. It's as simple as this, I think. Democrats have to, and the left have to be very cognizant of not only gerrymandering, which sort of feeds into this other problem, but the simple fact that the majority left presence in this country, and I think it's very reasonable to see that based on presidential popular vote results, it's inefficiently concentrated. It's too much in urban areas. It's too much, particularly in large urban areas. There are too many areas that are 80-20 Democratic and not enough that are 55-45 Democratic. So that means that if you simply sort of rely on standard mobilization techniques and sort of try to compete most vigorously in the areas who are already quite strong, that is not actually going to allow you to make the progress you need on House seats and state legislative seats and so on. In short, the left has to start more vigorously competing in areas where, they are not, the underlying demographics aren't overwhelmingly favorable to them. They actually have to compete, in congressional districts that are redder than maybe they're comfortable with. They have to compete in states that are redder than they're comfortable with. They have to have a presence and a mobilization strategy that takes in, pretty much most of the country and most of the counties in the country. And I think that's something that's really become very clear on the basis of the last series of election results.
And does that require policy changes? I mean, I know some of the history of your previous books, and it was way back in 2000 that you wrote the book America's Forgotten Majority, Why the White Working Class Still Matters. And here we are right after the 2016 election where that got proven in a way that really smacked the Democrats in the face. Clinton, as the nominee, had embraced a lot of the progressive policies of Bernie Sanders that were intended to help the white working class, free college tuition for their kids and on down the line, and yet they got roundly rejected in that demographic. So do they need policy change?
Well, I think they need two things. I think the first thing is, despite the fact that Clinton had a number of policies that would have benefited people in these areas and in these communities where she did quite poorly, I don't think they heard them very well. She didn't really campaign very intensively in these areas. She actually had some interesting plans that went beyond sort of national things like, free college to regional economic development plans that actually might have helped some of the communities in which she totally got thumped among white working class communities. But people didn't hear them. They didn't know about them. I think what Clinton was known for, and what the highest profile aspect of her campaign was, we are stronger together. I'm not Donald Trump. He's an intolerant boor. He's not the future. This is not the America we want, and so on, which are all fine sentiments. But if you're a white working class person in those kind of communities in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, whatever, that may not necessarily sort of excite you that much. And in fact, it sounds like you're much more concerned with other people than you are with them. So it seems to me the Democrats and the left need to put the problems of declining communities, particularly working class communities, front and center on their agenda. They not only have to talk to them, they have to talk about them. They have to have more sophisticated and more detailed plans about how they're going to help these people and sort of revive these communities and actually act like that's a central part of what they stand for. Because one of the things I really try to emphasize in this book is that the left does best when the economy is growing well and it's including, there's less inequality, it's distributing its benefits relatively widely. And if the left can deliver that to people, the left will be rewarded in terms of political support. It'll may be a lot easier to get their programs through. The amazing thing about the last 20 years, in my view, in some ways, is that the left has made as much progress as it has, despite the fact that we've had relatively poor, you know, economic performance. So the left needs to get to a space and to an economic model when it can actually lift up the country as a whole in a better way, and particularly these communities that are declining in a better way. And sort of that's got to be central to their strategy. Simply saying, we are the new America, we are the rising demographics, we're for tolerance. All those things are good, but that's not going to be enough to allow them to compete in the areas of the country we've been talking about and to ultimately do the kinds of things they'd like to do.
Joe in Long Island City, you're on WNYC with Rui Teixeira. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is about how to communicate with other people during divided times. So, for example, I was talking with my father recently about how to communicate with others about military policy. And he mentioned, oh, well, you know, the military's getting cut. We have no tank. We have no ships. We don't have any soldiers. Obama got rid of all of them. And I showed him from government facts that actually George Bush Sr. reduced the military by more, et cetera. But the facts didn't seem to change his mind. And I know that this is just one of millions of examples in the country right now. So how can we communicate with the right or other people who might be interested when facts don't matter?
Well, I think facts do matter. I think it's frustrating for people on the left when they repeat what they believe to be facts to someone with whom they disagree, and that person does not immediately recant and sign up with the left. I think that's a naive way of thinking about how people change. People change only over a period of time, and you may have to show them those facts 5, 10, 15, 20 times, and something in the nature of their life or the way the country is working might have to change as well. But I think that's no reason to give up on presenting facts to people. I think that one of the biggest mistakes the left makes is acting like the people with whom they disagree are morons or, you know, and this is particularly a problem in my view, are racists, are just, you know, social troglodytes who are, you know, sort of have these evil points of view on things. And I think this was a very common way to look at Trump voters in the last election. You still have a lot of people saying, I just, you know, anybody who voted for Trump, I just can't stand it. They're the worst people in the world. Well, that's a lot of people to be the worst people in the world. Yeah. They have many complicated reasons for supporting a candidate like Trump and having the view that they do. And the left has to communicate, we take that seriously.
Be the last word. Rui Teixeira, his new book, The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And folks, join me tonight at 8 o'clock when I host our national call-in show, Indivisible. Our topic tonight will be nationalism in the past and under Trump. Talk to you tonight and tomorrow morning back here on The Brian Lehrer Show.